Welcome to today's episode of Journal Club. I'm Malcolm Dix. Right now, in 2024, writing programs for quantum computers feels like you're writing code for IBM mainframes in the 1960s. Here's what it's like. You write your code. You find a vendor that has an available quantum computer that has a compiler compatible with your code. You send your code to that vendor in the hopes that they will compile and run your code sometime soon. You wait, and you wait, and you wait for minutes or hours or days, and you eventually get a readout back of the result of your program and or your errors. The whole process is like stepping into a time machine, and not in a good way. So, unsurprisingly, quantum software engineers are desperate for other options, desperate for modern platforms that can compile and run their code quickly and easily. This desperation makes them vulnerable to bad actors. There is so much unmet demand for quantum computers right now. There's such a scarce resource that any actor who releases a quantum computer and makes it available for engineers to use at a reasonable price will likely get their supply gobbled up. That is true even if the platform offering the computer is from an unknown entity, a malicious entity, or a state actor who the engineers would otherwise never do business with. In this new paper, the authors explore the attack service that would and likely will reveal itself when bad actors start offering quantum computing services. They also provide a set of mitigation techniques that engineers can use to flag suspicious actors and reduce the impacts of their activities. A quick note about these authors, this is published in one of Frontier's journals, and one or more of the authors declared that they were an editorial board member of Frontier's at the time of submission. I don't see any reason to believe this would create a conflict of interest in this case, I just wanted to let you know. Okay, back to the article. I'm going to assume, for the sake of this episode, that the listener has at least a passing familiarity with quantum computing. If you don't, that's okay. This paper is more about analyzing the results of quantum computers than their internal mechanisms. But in case you need a review before we continue, here's a very short oversimplification of a few things you need to know about quantum computing. 1. In a quantum computer, the basic unit of information is called a qubit, not a bit. While a traditional bit can represent 0 or 1, a qubit can represent 0, 1, or it can exist in a superposition of both simultaneously. For all intents and purposes, this ends up meaning that a qubit represents a combination of probabilities for 0 and 1, rather than a definite value itself, until the moment it's measured. 2. A quantum gate is an operation on one or more qubits, and a quantum circuit is a series of quantum gates. When you write code for a quantum computer, you're generally designing quantum circuits. This is more like writing assembly than a high-level programming language. 3. Quantum computers are usually designed to excel at combinatorial problems. When they're searching through a solution space, quantum computers can, in theory, use superpositioning and entanglement to process multiple solutions in parallel rather than in sequence. This is not the same as the type of parallelism that GPUs offer. The problem space is different. But the high-level benefits of parallelism are largely the same. 4. And this is the point most relevant to today's article. When you write code, a quantum circuit, for a quantum computer and send it out to be compiled and ran, what you get back is not the exact result of your calculation. You get back a distribution of results and the probability that those results are correct. So let's say there's a circle with an area of 100, and your program is trying to calculate that area based on some other inputs. If you wrote the program for a normal computer, you'd get back 100 as your result. With a quantum computer, you might get back 98, 99, 100, 101, 102, and a probability distribution for that set. If the quantum computer is running correctly, then the result closest to the true value of 100 will have the highest probability. Again, that is all definitely an oversimplification, but that's okay for now. With all that out of the way, let's get back to the problem these researchers were exploring. Let's say there's a new service offering quantum computing. Their service seems good, so you give them a try. As it turns out, that new vendor is a bad actor, and for some reason, they've decided to change the results of your program. In order to throw off your results, that host can employ two types of strategies, what the authors call random tampering and targeted tampering. Unlike in classical computing, you, the victim, won't have an easy way to validate your results, so this subterfuge goes undetected. In random tampering, the vendor would run your program as normal, then right before they return the results, they'd do a random bit flip on all the qubit lines. In targeted tampering, it's the same technique, except the host introduces the bit flip to specific qubit lines to target individual sections of the result distribution. In order to benchmark the viability of these attacks, they ran simulations in Qiskit, that's Q-I-S-K-I-T, and then also ran actual circuits on quantum hardware provided by IBM. It was called the IBM Q Manila. For evaluation, they used a performance metric, PM, that divided the probability of the correct output by the probability of the incorrect output. And they also used TVD. TVD allowed them to quantify just how far off a given result was from the correct result. They ran several tests utilizing different values for a tamper coefficient, T, which represented the aggressiveness of the tampering behavior. When the dust settled, one thing was clear. Both types of tampering worked, but targeted tampering, which is less invasive, slightly outperformed random tampering. When they set their tampering coefficient to 0.5, the probability distribution returned by the quantum computer consistently assigned a higher probability to an incorrect option than the correct one. In other words, they successfully messed up the results. So, given that this attack is possible, what can we do about it? The authors propose two options to mitigate this kind of attack: equal shot distribution and adaptive shot distribution. Both options rely on the same basic idea. Don't run your quantum workloads on only one quantum computer. They argue that using untrusted and potentially malicious vendors is fine for a significant part of your workload, but not the whole run. Quantum computers don't just run your program once, they do multiple shots, often in the thousands. Then they average out the results and return them as the probability distribution. So the author's argument is simple. Don't send all your shots to one vendor. Divide them up. That way, you can get the benefit of using the alternative vendors, that's getting your workloads ran more quickly, possibly for cheap, but also get the benefits of using a trusted vendor, valid results. In an equal shot distribution, you choose N vendors, make sure one of them is trusted, divide up your shots among them, and then use some basic statistics to make sure all the hardware are returning results that are plausible given the inputs. If one or more of the vendors are returning results that are inconsistent with the rest, you throw those results out. In adaptive shot distribution, you basically do the same thing, but with a smaller set of initial shots. And after the first round, you allocate more shots only to the vendors whose results were in line with the trusted vendor. The results of these techniques seemed impressive. They saw a 30x improvement in their performance metric, PM, along with a 0.25x improvement in TVD. That is to say, mitigating this kind of attack does seem plausible, assuming you have access to at least one trusted vendor. The question is, does this actually solve the problem we started with? I'd argue that it sort of does, but not really. Recall that the big issue is that engineers are desperate for quantum computer platforms as a whole. The vulnerability comes from the fact that engineers are being forced into a position where they need to use an untrusted vendor for their whole workload. This solution doesn't help with that. This solution assumes that you have a big workload and can send some of it to a trusted vendor. This, to me, sounds like a solution for an engineer who is trying to optimize the price they pay for quantum computing, not a solution for an engineer who wants to run workloads and can't get access to any computers. Still, the research has its merits. If you find yourself in a position where you want to allocate more of your quantum workloads to new vendors, possibly cheaper vendors who you don't trust, but you don't want to lose the validity of your results, then the strategy outlined in this paper might be a great preemptive defense against a malicious actor. I think the overall takeaway is this. If you don't trust the vendor, don't use their quantum computers at all. But if you're backed into a corner and need to push some of your workload to an untrusted vendor, then you can use these techniques to mitigate the risk. But as of today, there's no way to go all in on an untrusted vendor. There's just no way to validate your results. It's a problem, and for now, there's nothing we can do about it. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Journal Club. I hope you enjoyed it. Malcolm Digg signing off. See you tomorrow.